Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. You know, we haven't had an episode dedicated to the UK in some time. I think it really hasn't been since the heated days of Brexit that we've had an entire episode focused on the UK. And so we thought it's time. So today we're talking with Edward Ferguson about the view of the pandemic from the UK, and hopefully we'll get a chance to drill down on some of the implications for the UK and also talk about implications for transatlantic security. For those of you who don't know Edward Ferguson, he is the Minister Counselor of Defense at the British Embassy here in DC. He's also served as Her Majesty's Ambassador to Bosnia from 2014 to 2018, and has had a host of different posts in the UK Ministry of Defense, including the Head of Defense Strategy and Priorities from 2011 to 2014. So, Ed, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jim Andre. It's great to be talking to you.
And I guess we need to say that you're a neighbor of mine. So we live in a very interesting part of Washington where we have a lot of colleagues who actually live in the neighborhood.
Yes, absolutely. It's rather sociable, actually, on my 30 minutes of physical activity a day.
Yes, exactly. We can have little meetings along the road as long as we're 6 feet apart.
Exactly.
We were talking a little bit before we hit record about the fact that your role here in the United States is a little bit rare, that you're a minister counselor, but sitting here in DC. So we thought it might be useful for you just to talk a little bit about your role in the United States and maybe just to say a little bit about the UK's presence in the US.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So we have a very large operation here, I think twice the size of any other country in the defense sphere. And that really reflects the breadth and the depth of our defense relationship with the United States. So we have about 1,000 people, military and defense civilian, across 28 states. And that's overseen by our defense attaché, Air Vice Marshal Gavin Parker, and me as his civilian counterpart. The unusual bit is that I'm also the Minister of Defense's direct United States. So I am the lead on policy advice back to the United Kingdom and to our defense ministers around how we should be looking to develop and guide the relationship, both in the near and in the longer term. And that's really where my focus is, trying to ensure that we are constantly building and growing the relationship so that it is as fresh and vibrant as relevant 10 years from now as it has been over the last, you know, 5-6 decades. And so really a lot of my focus is on those longer term issues about how we modernize our nuclear deterrent, working very closely together. Extraordinary integration we have in that space and on intelligence, but also looking at how we are designing and building our future forces to ensure they're still interoperable, useful and usable alongside each other in operations around the world, as we have been for, you know, certainly the whole of my lifetime. How we're investing in future technologies to make sure we maintain our technological advantage, how we're working together on transatlantic security in the Euro-Atlantic theater and around the world. So a huge range of activity, and it's an incredible privilege to be here and doing such an exciting job at such an exciting time.
Well, we're definitely happy to have you here. And one of the issues we've spent a lot of time, for obvious reasons, talking about on the podcast is certainly the pandemic. And so as you're thinking about transatlantic security, can you just tell us a little bit about what the view from London looks like, or your view on how this pandemic is going to shape, affect transatlantic security, you know, whether or not it creates new risks, new opportunities, and kind of how the UK is going to fit into all of this?
So I think the obvious thing to say is that it's still early days. And of course, we're doing a huge amount of thinking about both the nearer term challenges of, you know, confronting and getting on top of the pandemic, and the role of militaries and defense organizations in supporting the civilian agencies on that, but also around some of the longer term impacts. I think there are undoubtedly risks, and we're seeing some of those in a whole range of areas. I mean, many of the risks and threats have not changed. They haven't gone away because of the pandemic. You know, we haven't seen an outbreak of world peace. And so we're still seeing IRGC vessels harassing, you know, coalition ships in the Gulf. We're seeing Russian exercises and maritime and air movements around the European theater. We're seeing disputes in the South China Sea, through which, you know, huge quantities of the global shipping travels and, you know, merchant marine traffic. So, you know, a lot of those issues that we are focused on around global security and prosperity are still always there and will remain there. But I think in some ways we're seeing an intensification of certain trends, disinformation being a really obvious one. This sort of fake news around the origins of the disease, China trying to divert attention onto other issues and so on. But at the same time, we're also seeing new opportunities for cooperation. I mean, China, again, as we've been working very closely with to secure access to personal protective equipment and so on, as is the United States. So, we're seeing, I think, different dynamics in play. Quite how this settles will depend a lot on, some of those macro factors, how quickly our economies start to bounce back, whether we're in a sort of a recession or a longer term depression, what that means for the wider world, including vulnerable countries at risk of conflict and instability, how we can work together to shore those up to prevent, further outbreaks of conflict or mass migration and other issues. So lots and lots of uncertainty at the moment, but certainly an enormous amount of analysis and work going on, both, in London, but also here, working very closely with our American friends to try and understand the situation and work out how we can best respond.
One of the questions you hear being thrown around a lot is the impact of the pandemic on defense spending in Europe and in the United States, for that matter. But, when looking at the UK, do you think that the pandemic is going to have a substantive impact on levels of defense spending in the UK? And as you look out at Europe, how do you think that will all play out?
I mean, it's difficult to say, isn't it? Because I think, again, the threats that have been driving increased defense spending in recent years have not gone away, and in many ways they're intensifying. But it's undoubtedly true that we're also, the pandemic has brought into sharp relief other threats and other risks that cannot be ignored. And I think it is a given that pandemics are going to be seen as a national security top priority for the foreseeable future amongst all countries. And the money will have to be found. I mean, it's interesting that actually the UK's National Risk Register has long had pandemics in its top tier of risk. Indeed, it is the top risk and has been for some time. But, particularly looking at influenza outbreak and what we're seeing now is slightly different. So we've always had quite a broad view of national security. And that has been reflected in the way that we invest as the UK in defence, but also in other arms of government. I suspect that what we will see is, not just pandemics, but other things that have seemed slightly distant risks suddenly feeling rather more proximate. Climate change, antimicrobial resistance, perhaps being two other examples where, I think these, I don't think you can call it a black swan, because we've all known that this is a very serious risk. But the fact that one of these, risk has materialized now, I think will really shine a spotlight on other areas of vulnerability as well.
It's interesting, just to kind of play on that point a bit about defense spending and the impact. A couple things real quick. What have you heard from your counterparts in NATO capitals who are also wrestling with this idea of impact on their own defense spending? NATO has the target of 2%. We're all aware of that long, long, long legacy, but and the progress that have been made. But it looks like now, if countries want to try to duck that, they've got a great excuse, which is trying to deal with the pandemic. It's more than an excuse, because the U.S., all of us, are going to have to deal with trying to cushion the economic blow. And government spending on domestic things are going to have to be part of that cushion. So what are you hearing from your counterparts as they wrestle with this? Is probably we're all sharing the same problem.
I mean, I think we're all, obviously looking very closely at the nature of our individual and collective economies. As 2% of GDP obviously depends on what's happening with GDP. If GDP is growing, then your defense budgets are growing. If we are into enduring recession, then that's obviously going to put a squeeze on defense budgets unless compensatory uplifts are made. So the nature of the economy is obviously a big factor there. I think there are definitely challenges for the institutions of NATO, European Union, and others around how do they step up to prove their utility and relevance against this broader context where I think publics will be more demanding around some of these areas in the future. And it will, you know, I think there will be a case to be made for the continued importance of investment in traditional defense and security and deterrence. You know, the requirement really has not gone away, and certainly from when I was the head of strategy in the Ministry of Defense, you know, until 2014, which was pre-Ukraine invasion, you know, this sort of given now around great competition. You know, it looked very different. And so, you know, I think the case has been building, but now there is, you know, there are these new contenders for attention and funding. And I think that's a live discussion I don't think anyone knows the answer to quite yet. And, you know, we have postponed the UK's integrated review, which was going to be a very broad ranging defense, security, foreign policy review, the broadest since the Cold War, to look at our role in Europe and in the wider world as we kind of come out of the European Union. We've postponed that, I think, quite rightly, because, you know, there are so many unknowns at the moment that we really need just to take some time and take stock and work out what is the right balance of investment, you know, across defence, but also across our health system and other areas that are, you know, hugely in need of resilience at the moment.
Well, let's play on that point just for a second. Your strategic review, which is always so important, and the U.S., of course, you all consult with us and other allies too about what your thinking is and what our thinking is, and so that's actually a very big deal that we take quite seriously. But you know what's interesting is your Prime Minister Boris Johnson is, you know, certainly in Washington he's known for his role in Brexit, and you know, he was a journalist. He's got quite a career, author of a book on Churchill, as a matter of fact, that I read. And you know, so quite a you know, quite a background, but you know, there's not a lot known in terms of his thinking about defense, what his priorities are. He's the prime minister now. He's of course going to be deeply engaged in the review, which has now been postponed, of course. But could you give us just a thumbnail on kind of what he has said in the past and what his thinking is about UK defense and UK military and the kind of the marching orders he gave you all as you set out to do your review.
So I think the sort of headline is that the Prime Minister is an internationalist. You know, yes, he was obviously involved in the Brexit campaign. He also coined the phrase "Global Britain," which was really designed to make this point that, you know, withdrawal from the European Union is an institutional issue. It's not about withdrawal from international affairs or from global engagement. And I think he is ambitious for the UK's role in the world. I know he is ambitious for our partnership with the United States. And of course, in many ways, that is built upon our relationship on defence and security and intelligence. So I think, you know, that will be a big factor amongst many factors that we're now going to have to look at in the integrated review as it gets going, and say quite when that will be, I don't know at this point. But, you know, against a really challenging security environment, it's, you know, we absolutely need to take stock and to think very broadly and strategically about the future.
But he doesn't have a particular pet rock, if you will, in terms of defense. He's not a Royal Navy guy, or he has this global orientation and global Britain, as you point out, you know, having the ability to protect his interests globally. But he doesn't have, in terms of the military, a particular interest or passion.
No, I don't think there's a particular branch or service that he'd be particularly focused on. I think undoubtedly there will be more of a focus on the role that the military can offer and the armed forces can offer in terms of supporting wider resilience, societal resilience, institutional resilience, particularly in the wake of the pandemic. But of course, you know, our core mission of ensuring defence and deterrence and security has not gone away. And, you know, of course, what we've been talking about both nationally and within NATO is to ensure that this health crisis does not become a security crisis.
Right.
And that, you know, that fundamental requirement to ensure that, you know, no one sees this as an opportunity to create mischief remains as relevant and as important as ever.
Just shift gears a little bit. You were talking about kind of a broader definition of national security, and I think you mentioned disinformation under that umbrella. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we've certainly seen with COVID is China really step up its efforts and kind of even adopting some of the tactics that the Russians have used on the disinformation front. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the China question and how that narrative is playing out in the UK. I mean, on one hand, you know, you've seen China kind of try to take advantage of the situation to present itself as an alternative, a global leader. But the other narrative is that people now can see China for what it is, the fact that it's tried to use this pandemic opportunistically to advance its own kind of global ambitions. And I wonder kind of how you see, where do you think the UK, the public, sits in on that spectrum, and kind of how China's actions and efforts in Europe in the wake of the pandemic are being viewed from London and across the UK?
So I think, I think this is clearly, it's a big question right now in the United States, of course, and around the world. China remains a really important country and a very important partner in many ways. If China's economy is not growing, then the global economy is unlikely to be growing, and we need to return to growth. The supply chains and the way that they have evolved over recent years, so many of the medical supply chains now rooted in China, and we're seeing, of course, the critical role that China is playing in providing us with the equipment we need to get through this pandemic. So really important roles. That's not to say that we agree with China on everything, and that again predates this crisis, whether it's Xinjiang or whether it's the South China Sea or Hong Kong and other issues, where we've been clear where we have a difference of view, and we've been clear as well where we, in calling out what we see as unacceptable behaviours, whether that is cyber attacks, where we have attributed certain attacks quite clearly. And in this case, I think, the disinformation is obviously, unhelpful. What's really important in a crisis like this is we need to have facts and data to allow us the scientific development of solutions. Disinformation from whatever quarter is hugely unhelpful. I think there is also a kind of competition around messaging, which, who is the most helpful and supportive to different countries, where, I think there is room for everyone to offer help at the moment. Anyone who can offer help to countries, I don't think that, we should turn up our noses at that. I think perhaps there's a challenge to Western countries to be a bit better at sales and marketing about what we're doing. Having been an ambassador in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the European Union are by far the biggest donors to the Western Balkans in this crisis. But in some cases, China or Russia have been getting more attention, more plaudits. They're providing help, good. But we should also make sure that people recognize where we are helping out as well.
Well, that's something that we've been watching very closely here in terms of the this campaign to have this misinformation campaign. And I just heard this morning the Swedish foreign minister did a similar thing here. It wasn't a podcast, but it was with the Atlantic Council, where she was talking about the problems with this misinformation coming into the Nordic Baltic area from Russia, and having to push back on that and trying to deal with, as you point out, the public relations part of this. And I think in a lot of ways, this is raising not necessarily new missions, but perhaps a new emphasis on things that NATO needs to be doing. And this impact on NATO and the EU as institutions and their role in terms of trying to help out on something that in terms of NATO isn't necessarily a military thing, a defense thing. It's not something you do in defense planning and this type of thing at NATO. Yet NATO has capabilities that can swing into something that's not a purely military problem, but it could, whether it's cyber or whether it's misinformation or whether it's something like a pandemic, they've got a role to play. And I'm wondering, is the UK looking at NATO in a way that that maybe it can do a better job next time? I'm not saying that NATO's doing a bad job. I think NATO did swing in late, but it did swing in and began to help. But I think there's a lot of thinking that, we've got to be better at using some of the tools in our toolbox for things that are not the traditional kind of mission you would expect.
I'm sure. Absolutely. I think this is there are going to be, all sorts of lessons this pandemic throws up. And we have absolutely, as individual countries, but also as institutions, need to look at where we can do better and react quicker and make sure we have the right stockpiles or the right logistics or the right plans in place to aid those who are going to need it. Disinformation, I think, is, again, this is certainly not a new issue. Having spent the last 4 years in the Western Balkans, it's absolutely not a new issue. And countries like Russia have been investing very heavily in outlets like Sputnik that, you know, are a constant source of free, often, stories that cast doubt and obfuscate and so on. I think what the pandemic has done is put a lot of that on steroids. I think as like-minded countries, we all need to be talking to each other, and indeed we are, about how do we, you know, win this battle of the narratives, because it's absolutely clear, I think, that our countries, there are definitely weaknesses and challenges, but we're open about where those are and we're learning from them. Whereas others, I think, are obscuring the challenges that they've faced and trying to portray that, you know, different systems or non-democratic systems can be more effective. I simply don't believe that's true. And I think there are opportunities here for institutions like NATO and the European Union to work more closely together on these issues with capitals, to align our messaging, to make sure that we are feeding information where we see it. You know, we don't want to get into a whack-a-mole, shoot every story down, because frankly, that's playing, you know, their game. But let's get a strong narrative of our own. Let's work, and let's work out how we explain, you know, truthfully and objectively where the strengths are and how we're working collectively and in solidarity as, you know, NATO allies or as European partners, transatlantic partners, indeed, to combat this this pandemic and learn from it.
Well, while we're talking about institutions, just to squeeze in a quick question. I know Andrea's got a question too, but how are things going between UK and EU as you're dealing with the defense relationship? That's certainly one important to the EU. They need a strong relationship with the UK when it comes to military and defense. And you don't hear as much about those discussions as you do about trade and the movements of people and that kind of thing. But how are things going with the EU in terms of being a third party? Welcome to the club. Being a third party dealing with the EU. And are those, I would imagine the discussions have been put on hold with the pandemic, but how has that been going?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think discussions have certainly been slowed by the pandemic around sort of defense. I sort of referred to the Prime Minister's adage that, you know, we are global Britain, and we've left the European Union, we haven't left Europe. And, you know, Europe is our continent and it is our security in our backyard. So we're absolutely committed to NATO and to working with the European Union where that makes sense to do so. We'll exactly the modalities of that. I think at this stage we're pretty flexible and we're open to discussions. I mean, again, sorry to keep going back to my time in Bosnia and Herzegovina, but we contribute to the European Union peacekeeping force there. Quite importantly, both with staff on the ground, but also with the Over the Horizon Reserve Force. Personally, I would hope that we can get to a point where UK contributions to EU missions, as other non-EU contributors, can continue where that makes sense. But it's early days, and we'll see how this develops over time.
Maybe just continuing on this institutions front, I think there's been a lot of discussion about kind of the need for a greater NATO-EU coordination. So certainly on things like the pandemic, but also, you know, per my earlier question on China, as Europe continues to think about how it's going to address the challenge of China, most of that is probably better addressed through EU capabilities and tools rather than NATO's. But so can you just tell us a little bit about kind of the current extent of coordination between EU and NATO? What does that look like? And if you could kind of paint a roadmap for areas where you could see that improve, what would you like to see?
But I mean, I think it's worth saying that there are a whole range of different fora in which to have discussions around, you know, some of the longer term implications. The G7 is another one. Foreign ministers met recently and have been looking about how we can coordinate in terms of the health response, in terms of vaccine development, in terms of funding. You know, we've doubled our we put £744 million, nearly $1 billion, into vaccine development. We've doubled our contribution to the IMF to help vulnerable countries. And we're doing that in as coordinated a fashion as we can with other partners. So there's a very broad conversation that goes well beyond the European Union on this. On the specifics of your question, you know, I think at the recent NATO ministers meeting, the high representative from the EU was present as well. And I think, you know, that dynamic is very much a positive one at the moment. You know, examples like, you know, thinking about how NATO can use its logistics skills and assets to deliver equipment that the EU is procuring around the European continent or elsewhere. You know, there are really, I think, valuable synergies to be gained playing to the strengths of each institution, and somewhere we all have a role to play, including around messaging, as we discussed earlier.
Your comment about the UK has left the EU, but you haven't left Europe, that it's your backyard. And so as you look in the wake of the pandemic at trends that are playing out in Europe, what concerns you most?
I think, again, we'll have to see a little bit about how things shake down, because it is early days and many countries are, you know, still weathering the storm. I think, you know, we'll have to see whether there are different rates of recovery, particularly perhaps between the north and the south of Europe. And I think that will pose challenges. What we need to ensure, I think, from a European, from a NATO perspective, is as far as possible solidarity between, you know, between allies and partners. And so we'll all have to be looking at how we can support each other to make sure that we don't end up with a kind of strong divide between the haves and the have-nots. You know, I think we'll also have to see what happens as the virus intensifies in Africa and to the south. If there are conflicts growing around, you know, collapses of health systems or economies, and what that might mean for migration and so on, that could inject new tensions into European politics. How Russia might respond as the virus gains pace there, and as, you know, oil markets are severely depressed in terms of oil price. What, you know, we have to watch out, I think, for Russian opportunism. There are a whole bunch of stuff that I think we'll need to be live to. And I think that means that different countries might be looking in different directions, whether east or south, with different degrees of urgency. I think the best antidote to this is we keep talking. And that's what we do, what we plan to do. As I say, we've got different fora in which we can do that. But I think, as ever, you know, this partnership between the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, France will remain really important, and we can continue to play a leadership role, not just in the Euro-Atlantic space, but globally, in terms of finding practical, pragmatic solutions based on scientific fact and truth.
I know we're getting short on time, and so I have just a final question. And, you're relatively new to Washington. You arrived, I think, last year in the fall, is that
yeah,
right?
About a year ago. Yeah, a year ago, yeah.
And your ambassador has just arrived, I think, over the past month, and now she's there. And so, new prime minister in a lot of ways. He's been around for a little while, but then, of course, Brexit has happened. So, for the UK, there's a lot of, certainly for the embassy here in Washington, there's a lot of new people and new prime minister, a new position globally and in Europe after Brexit. So what can we expect from the embassy with the new team and the new prime minister and new situation? Is there going to be, are you all going to do new things? Are we going to see more Beatles flavored events like we used to see in years past that were a lot of fun, or cool Britain kind of thing? Or what's the embassy and the new ambassador going to be bringing to the Washington diplomatic scene?
So our new ambassador, Karen Pierce, as you said, she just arrived from New York. So she's been in the United States for a little while. She was our ambassador to the United Nations before, and I've worked with her for years on Afghanistan, on the Balkans, and other places. She is amazing, and that's not me toadying. I've always felt that, despite the fact she's now my boss again. And she loves a great party as well. So I think we're going to see some great parties as soon as we can back at the residence. In terms of substance, though, you know, she and the Prime Minister, as I say, are really ambitious for this relationship. And certainly from a defence perspective, you know, what we've been trying to do, certainly since my arrival, is think kind of longer term and more broadly and strategically around how we build and grow the relationship. I touched on this at the beginning, but there are key things that we need to get to grips with in this very complicated changing environment. You know, even before the pandemic, of course, that's now an additional factor. You know, how do we respond to the challenge of increased competition from near-peer competitors? How do we, you know, respond to the pace of technology change and maintain technological advantage? And we see huge value in looking at those questions together. There are a lot of brains lined up against us or in competition with us. You know, let's pool our brains, our collective wits, our industrial and scientific capabilities, our military forces, and work out how do we work together to, you know, to maintain this position that we have enjoyed for a long time of being influential and able to shape global events in the interests of global security and prosperity. And so, you know, there's a lot to be done. And I think, you know, notwithstanding the constraints of COVID, and we're all a bit frustrated at being shut in our houses, you know, and not able to get out and have some of the conversations we'd like to have. But, you know, we're really keen to be part of that conversation. And worth saying, you know, on this podcast, really keen to engage with a very wide cross-section of thought with the administration, with Congress, with think tanks like yourselves, with industry, with new demographics. This is a changing country, as is ours, and we need to make sure that, you know, the next generations are as interested in the transatlantic relationship as previous ones have been.
Right.
So a huge amount to do, but I think, you know, vast potential to build on what's already there, which is an extraordinarily rich, deep, and advanced relationship on defense, on intelligence, on the economy as well. We're each other's biggest investors. Our industries, not just on defense, but including on defense, are intertwined and world-beating. You know, we can do amazing things together as we have in the past, and I think that should be our aspiration for the future.
Well, that sounds great. I know Andrea and I expect to be on your invitation list.
Absolutely.
You firmly are, of course.
we add a lot to the diplomatic scene, so we look forward to doing that at the embassy as well.
Brilliant. Well, and ditto. You know, we'd love to be as present as we can be in the events you're organizing.
Absolutely. Well, Ed, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. And we hope it's the beginning of several podcasts. We'd love to have your ambassador. But as you said, I think the constant dialogue and the conversations about how to move forward together are, you know, is perhaps the most important coming out of this crisis. And so we continue.
Absolutely.
We're looking forward to the opportunity to continue that conversation with you all.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for your time. Lovely to speak to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.